Okay. So, Eliana, you live here in New York, right?
Yes.
How long have you lived here?
I moved to New York in 1981.
1981.
Yes.
Is that when you left Brazil?
That's when I left Brazil. Long time.
And you grew up in São Paulo?
Yes.
Oh, you're going to have to help me with some of the pronunciation
you
here
did
because
good.
Portuguese is a rough language.
It is. It is very difficult language. But São Paulo, that's right. That's where I'm from.
Did you learn English as you were growing up? When did you begin to speak English?
No, actually, I went to Italian school because my grandparents were Italian. So I learned Italian, and that was a second language, and you know, of course, speaking Portuguese. But when I had my wishes to move to the U.S. and I knew I wanted to, I started taking a few private lessons. Just learning a little bit. But when I moved, I spoke so little.
You came to New York and you spoke a little Italian and you spoke Portuguese?
But no English.
Oh. So what did you do when you first got here?
Well, I actually learned the language quickly. And when I came to New York, it was interesting because I, first of all, start looking for a place to live, and I was able to rent a little apartment. I came with my savings. You know, I had worked a lot in Brazil,
mm-hmm.
and I lived with my parents during those years, so I saved all the money I worked.
Right.
You know, and then I came with my savings and found a little studio that they rented for a tourist without a problem. And then I went to Steinway & Sons and looked at all those amazing pianos and was taken by them and got a piano to be, you know, to go to my studio and upright so I could, rented a piano so I could, continue practicing. And then I started going to the clubs. And I had a cassette at the time. It was a cassette from
uh-huh.
music that I had prepared as a demo in Brazil. And I would go to jam sessions. And very quickly I was employed and working and going.
I'm still stuck on the Steinway in the studio apartment. Did you have a piano and a bed? And that's about it?
No, my studio was really cute.
Okay.
In fact, whoever would come into my studio would say, wow, this looks great. Because I really love home. You know, I like pretty home, clean, neat, and you know, that feels nice. And I'm very, visually stimulated by things, too, and very affected by my environment. So I like something nice. So I actually had a nice full-size bed with a beautiful comforter, little table with the two chairs and a little dresser. And, you know, my closet and the piano there, little rugs. It was really cute.
So if you are, would you describe yourself as a homebody?
Well, you know, I am a homebody, but I'm never home, though.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, is how do you reconcile that side of your spirit and the fact that you have to be on the road doing gigs all the time?
I'm always on the road.
Mm-hmm.
When I come home, it's just for a moment, you know, changing suitcases and doing a few days, and then I'm back again, you know, traveling. And when I'm traveling, I enjoy because I'm with a lot of people. I love people, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to interact with different people. And we're always attending things and dinners and this and that and the performances. But then when I'm home, you know, if I have a chance to be quiet, that's what I like to do and just be alone with my instrument and creating because that's where all the projects and everything I do come from those moments that I am by myself. You know, with my instrument. So I need those moments.
I can understand that because on Bossa Nova Stories, you also did all of the arrangements.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And fine arrangements they are.
Thank you. Thank you.
Really enjoyed the album. You were classically trained as a pianist, is that right?
That's right.
And your mom was a pianist.
My mother played classical.
Uh-huh.
But she loved jazz. Very unusual. You know, for the Brazilians, but she loved jazz and had an amazing collection of jazz records. So I grew up listening. It was a fantastic time because Brazilian music was exploding. Bossa Nova was exploding. It was all around us. It was on the radio. It was on TV. It was on the streets, television, everywhere. So that music was there. Besides that, in my own house, there were records playing all the time. like Art Tatum, Bud Powell, Nat King Cole, Wynton Kelly. I can go on and on, you know, to Bill Evans, to Oscar Peterson. So the music was there. And I grew up listening to the jazz as probably more than any American child, average American child would hear jazz at home.
Mm-hmm.
It was like I was in the United States. And the Brazilian music. And with my mother who played classical music and who sent me to have lessons when I was 7 years old. Just normal, formal training, like classical lessons, and became very clear and very apparent to the teacher, to everyone, the type of talent that they were dealing with. And I was a young kid, but I still have memories of going to the piano lessons and looking over, playing something, and looking, and the teacher would have tears, you know.
Wow.
And then sometimes I would see her call her husband or her mother, because she had a mother, a husband there, whatever, and they had tears, and it became a little hard for me at 7 years old. I didn't want to go back to the lessons because, Mom, why do they cry, you know, when I play? And my mom had to say, no, because you have a way of playing, even the simple little exercises, but you have a way of playing that is touching them, you know. And then I, you know, started seeing that the kids that were studying for a couple of years, I would do everything they did in 2 years, in 2 months, and be, you know, going way farther, you know, that they were musically. So it became very early clear that not that I chose music, but that music chose me. Like, it became really a strong part of me. And so I devoted myself and started, I learned. I was very good with math as well, so I learned how to do all subdivisions of rhythm.
Wow.
And how to divide. So every time when I was a little kid, I would hear music, I would see all of the notes that would go by, because I could hear everything. So once I knew how to subdivide rhythm and divide, you know, like all the subdivisions of 64, 32, all of those things, how to do that, I would hear something. Say, I would go sit by my record player and hear, let's say, Art Tatum or Bud Powell. And with the record player, I would drop the needle and take it back and write what I heard. And then I would do it again and write what I heard. So when I was 10, 11 years old, I had this huge repertoire of all those songs that I transcribed and wrote everything down, and I would play along with those records. Then became this child prodigy. And I was accepted then at age 13 to Brazil's best school of music.
Mm-hmm.
And I graduated, I was 15, and started teaching there in the piano department at that age. 2 years later, when I was 17, I was playing, I had a trio, jazz trio, and I was playing in a nightclub, and a little table, like very near the piano, I looked over, it was Antonio Carlos Jobim with his co-writer, Vinicius de Moraes and Toquinho. They invited me to join them on their international tours.
Wow.
At first, I said, I don't think I want to do it because I don't want to travel so much. My mother's going to go ahead, do it. Okay, I'm going to do it. So then I start this whole new venture with the great creators of the Brazilian music.
Were you frightened at any
no,
point? Nervous?
No. Never.
Tell us what those legendary guys were like.
Vinicius de Moraes, who co-wrote with Jobim, was an amazing person. He had no attachment to worldly possessions. Okay, he was a man who whatever he had was to give away.
Hmm.
He he had like 9 different wives during his life. So he was always looking for love, you know, which in retrospect, I wonder if he was ever happy.
Mm-hmm.
Because if he was looking all the time, that means he had not found. But he had a vision of life that was so incredible, so different than anyone that I had dealt with. He was a poet. He was one of Brazil's greatest poets. And he was a diplomat and a man with a vision that for a 17-year-old in the 3 years that I spent with him, he was so influential in showing me a whole different way of looking at life. and something that many people do not have an opportunity to even imagine. So it was really important to me. And Jobim, of course, was a tremendous, tremendous influence. I mean, I witnessed moments of them together and composing and the way they approached the music. And Toquinho, who was the guitarist with them, and very a great composer too, who wrote music with them, who also, with him, I really learned the art of accompanying and sharing the piano chair rhythmically with guitar and drums and all of that. So it was a fantastic time for me.
I can imagine. That sounds like Vinicius de Moraes was sort of way ahead of his time. That's the kind of spare spareness of possessions and greater spirituality,
yes,
that people are talking about now.
Much, much, much greater. Much greater. I mean, he was incredible. He was all goodness, and he loved people. And his songs, I mean, what he talked about, the depth of what he talked about, it was just so incredible. I cannot tell you enough about that time of my life.
And you played with him for 3 years, is that right? You toured with Vinicius?
Yes, we toured nonstop. We would go to, say, Buenos Aires and stay for a month and a half playing in the same theater. Like the same thing when you have a Broadway show and it stays for a month or two somewhere or three. That's how big they were.
Wow.
That's they like, would go and stay like 2 months in a theater here and then 2 months in another theater there. So I was with him all the time.
Wow. And what about Antonio Carlos Jobim?
He was on some of it. He wasn't there all the time.
What was he like?
Oh, he was a wonderful man. He had, you know, this incredible, very simple person. Also, you know, like someone, he was very connected to nature.
Hmm.
So inspired by nature. I mean, he really liked to be in the middle and aware in the green. The birds had an amazing effect on him. Just the foliage, the just nature. He loved nature. He loved women. And he had this he wrote several songs, you know, with names of different women.
Uh-huh.
And he had this little comment he used to make. It doesn't translate so great in English, but basically like, every woman that I did not have is a song that I wrote.
Ah, yes, sounds like most musicians to me. Now, much later, in 1989, you created an album, recorded an album for Blue Note called Eliane Elias Plays Jobim, right? Mm-hmm. So tell us, something happened that also involved him at that time. He became ill, right? And he was about to record an album.
In 1989, I recorded the tribute, Eliane Elias Plays Jobim.
Mm-hmm.
That tribute, Jobim was well and mm-hmm. alive.
Okay.
And I was going to do his music, but not, I mean, having some artistic freedom, still keeping the authenticity of what he wrote, but really putting a lot of my own personality into it and my input into it. So I went, he had an apartment at Central Park.
Okay.
In Madison, actually, Madison Avenue by Central Park. And I went and said, look, I'm going to show you what I'm going to do. And I showed him some of the arrangements, and he had this big eyeballs. He looked at me and said, whoa, did I write that? Like, he really liked it because I changed some things, but he loved it. And I said, I want to have your blessing because you're the composer and I'm taking liberty here to do things. And he loved it. So I recorded that tribute, which was very, very, you know, was critically acclaimed and was something very interesting. A few years later, because we're talking about Jobim, a few years later, he was going to record for Polygram
mm-hmm.
A recording called Double Rainbow, which was going to be the two sides of Jobim. Half of the recording would be with American musicians Herbie Hancock and Christian McBride, I think was Jack DeJohnette on drums, and Joe Henderson. And the other half was going to be himself, with the Brazilians, with Oscar Castro Neves, Paulo Braga, and the Brazilian team.
Mm-hmm.
And he got ill. he could not do the recording. So it was going to be canceled. When he said, no, don't cancel, he called me and said, look, you are the one person that I trust to do this, and that I know that although you do all these complicated things, you also know my heart and my soul, and you can represent me the way I would have played on this. And it was a tremendous validation, you know, because it was the end of his life when he came to me and said something like this. And I went with my heart, I cannot tell you how I felt.
I'm sure.
And I went to do the recording for him, and he did hear it, but he passed away after that. And, you know, that was a hard time for all of us when we lost him.
But it's almost as if he passed the mantle.
Yes.
To you, yes. In a very real way. That
yes.
Must have
oh, very much.
Been very moving
very
for
much.
You. You chose to record Bossa Nova stories with some wonderful musicians, some of whom are legendary Bossa Nova musicians and some of whom are a little bit newer to the genre. Can you tell us a little bit about the personnel?
Sure. On guitar, Oscar Castro Neves, who is legendary, he was there at the inception of the Bossa Nova, together with Jobim. He is one of a kind, and we have such an affinity, a rhythmical affinity. It's just fantastic to have him, and I couldn't imagine doing a Bossa Nova tribute without him. On drums, Paulo Braga, who was Jobim's drummer.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. For the last 20 years of Jobim's life. In fact, on this recording that I did in the place of Jobim, it was going to be Oscar Castro Neves and Paulo Braga. You know, that's how we first played together. It was through that recording. And on bass is Mark Johnson, who is not a Brazilian person, but he has played with me for the last 21 years, and he has absorbed the Brazilian music to a place that I couldn't imagine having anyone else playing the bass, playing this music. Because not only he knows the Brazilian music at depth, but he's a virtuoso and someone who plays the acoustic bass with such class and beautiful virtuosity, beauty, that he's the one, you know. And it's no one else I would want to have. And then besides us, the quartet that we have been playing together, Ivan Lins, a great Brazilian singer-songwriter. Mm-hmm. And he's a guest in one of the tunes. Toots Tillmans, whom I first met back in 1984. And Toots Tillmans has always had a love affair with Brazilian music mm-hmm. for decades. And he was very supportive of my music and my writing. He has recorded some of my originals on his records.
Really?
Yes.
That's neat.
Yes, And we also toured together quite a bit with a group called the Brazil Project, which was myself and Oscar and Ivan Lins and Toots. So it's all kind of in the family. So he's part of the recording. And then there's a young guitar player called Ricardo Volt, very young. And he's on two of the tracks, and he plays beautiful. And we have orchestra that was recorded at Abbey Road. I mean, a dream come true.
Did you attend those recordings of the orchestrations
yes.
at Abbey Road? You have to tell us what it's like to walk into Abbey Road Studios.
You walk into that is really something so powerful. Mm-hmm. I mean, the room that we record. First of all, I didn't see it empty because I walked in and all those musicians were there, this huge room. And then all the history of all the great movie soundtracks and the Beatles and everything that was done there is just overwhelming. I mean, it's just impressive and beautiful. And the players are part of the London Philharmonic.
Mm-hmm.
So they're just top, beautiful players.
And they were there for you. That must have blown your mind just a little bit.
I cannot tell you. And when you have the music on paper, you know, you idealize the music, you discuss, you have it. Okay. But then you sit in there and you actually hear all those strings, like doing that. It's just, I had goosebumps and tears and you name it.
Because they were playing your arrangement, so it
yes,
was really
beautiful.
Now, we were talking before we came on mic about the wonderful Bruce Lundvall, who's the president of Blue Note Records. Tell us how you signed if you wouldn't mind repeating that story so we can record it for posterity, tell us about how you met Bruce and how you signed with Blue Note.
Sure. You know, Bruce was such a great strength in my career and a supporter of my music. First of all, Bruce is one of a kind. I mean, he loves the music. He has knowledge of the music. And speaking for myself, he signed me. I was one of the first artists signed to Blue Note at its revival. Mm-hmm. Because the revival was 1984, and I signed in 1985.
Wow.
And had I not left Blue Note, I would be the longest signed artist they ever had. But even when I'm on Blue Note again, but I left for about 3 years. And when I left, I was the longest signed artist since the revival. I was there for over 16 years. And I took a 3-year break, and I'm back home again. And Bruce has always given me total freedom, artistic freedom, to do anything that I wanted to do with the music. And, you know, even when I worked with Steps Ahead, with Elektra Musician, he was then the president at Elektra Musician. And we recorded for him back, that's back in 83, and then I went to Blue Note. But it's been like family, you know, and he was so sweet to me when I was going to leave Sony BMG. This was about a year and a half ago. And I went to speak with him. I said, well, you know, before I go anywhere else, let me speak with you. And he says, no, you have to come back. This is like a child coming back home. You're back home now. You went away for a little while. You're back home. And that's how I feel.
That's really beautiful.
Yeah.
On Bossa Nova Stories, you record some really classic Bossa Nova songs, and you also record some songs that are not customarily given the Bossa Nova treatment.
Right.
So how did you select those for the album?
Well, you know, first I wanted to do the songs that were there at the inception, the songs that launched the Bossa Nova, which were Chega de Saudade, Desafinado, and Minha Saudade. Girl from Ipanema came 2 years later, or it came in 62 or something like this, but Girl from Ipanema really opened all the doors, even more, wider doors for Brazilian music. So, of course, that would be a must to include. And other Brazilian songs that were chosen, you know, that I chose to do. But I also wanted to keep in a tradition of some of the classic Bossa Nova recordings that were done by João Gilberto, even by Jobim himself, and include American standards done as Bossa Nova. Jobim himself loved Gershwin, and he recorded Fascinating Rhythm and, you know, other Gershwin songs. So I figured it would be great to include a Gershwin song. João Gilberto recorded Estate, which was an Italian song.
Is that so? I've heard some. Yes. I've heard it's but done
yes.
by mostly Brazilian
yes.
artists. That's
yes.
really
so,
interesting.
So he always brought standards from other countries. So I figure we have to give continuity. And so I included a Stevie Wonder song and a Superwoman and The More I See You. And They Can't Take That Away From Me. Marvelous for Words. Mm-hmm. You know that Jobim had recorded with Sinatra. They had Bubbles, Bangles, and Beads, if you remember
that. I have those albums,
so
yes.
It's very important to continue that tradition, in my opinion, and have the Brazilian and the other standards done as a bossa nova in order for people to even know that, you know, to give continuity to this language. It's an open, it's about the music. It doesn't exactly have to be Brazilian, but it can be another, you know, it can be a song from somewhere else done in a Brazilian way, you know. Mm-hmm. So I did that, and again, included other composers, other Brazilian composers that were important, like Ivan Lins is a more contemporary composer, but we sing a duet there, and a song called I'm Not Alone, João Donato, who is actually pre-Bossa Nova, and Geraldo Pereira, who wrote Aran, which means the frog, and Falsa Baiana, which is a fake baiana, you know, all of those songs. And that's how I chose. I mean, and ultimately, the songs chosen, they have to be songs that I like to sing, that I like the lyrics, and that I feel that I can share with you guys, you know, and want to tell you the message about it, and songs that I would be that are a good vehicle for the rhythm, the bossa nova, you know, because bossa nova is really a sensibility. It's more than you know, it's really a sensibility. I mean, it's cool, it has sensuality, it has that contagious rhythm. And what songs will work with that, you know, the choices are very, very important, I think.
You mentioned the lyrics of the song, and I wanted to ask you, since you started out as a pianist, when did you begin to sing? And was that a natural offshoot for you, or was it difficult to begin singing?
I prepared myself as a young musician to be a pianist and not to have barriers with my instrument, you know, to really be able to execute and play whatever would be. I mean, really to be a pianist on a level of the pianist that I would be hearing on my recordings and all of that. And when I moved to New York, I fully intended to just continue my work as a pianist, develop that work and continue doing that. My very first recording with my former husband, Randy Brecker, mm-hmm. was called Amanda. It was back in 1984. It was a whole singing record. It was a all vocal record. I didn't want to sing.
Okay.
But Randy wanted me to sing. Oh, no, you've got to sing. Okay. And I sang that whole record. I was like 8 months pregnant, you know, like I could hardly breathe. My diaphragm was, you know.
Somebody was sitting on it, essentially.
Oh, yes. But, and then after that, I stayed with the trio, you know, and establishing myself as a jazz pianist. That's what I wanted to do. And it was not until 89, first time, that I was doing this recording called Eliane Elias Play Jobim. And I was showing a ballad to the musicians called Don't Ever Go Away. Jobim ballad. But I was singing to them the ballad. Oh, this is the ballad we're going to do, just to give you an idea, you know, because we didn't rehearse. We did everything in the studio. And I'm singing. They say, you've got to sing. You've got to sing on the record. I'm going, oh, no. I don't want to sing. This is an instrumental record. I don't want to. No, you've got to sing. So I said, okay, I tell you what. Let's do the instrumental version. I promise you I'll do a little version singing at the end of the record. So we did, and I recorded this tune in two versions, the trio and then the one singing. I started doing my gigs, and I would sing that tune, and people would go, please sing some more, please sing some more. Next, I hear, oh, and when I sang in the studio, it was like embarrassing. Everybody was like, you know, they all, your eye, the engineer, the musicians, and I'm going, oh my God, okay. And then I heard that Manhattan School of Music and other music schools were using of this song on the music, on the vocal department, for the students to understand how to interpret a song. And I was a little bit like, wait a minute, because my idea for a singer would be to be as accomplished as I am a pianist.
Oh, yeah.
Like to be able to do all this, you know, acrobat things, that I can do anything on the piano. I cannot do that with my voice. So why are they using, you know? And they said, no, but your voice, the sound of your voice and the way your phrasing is in your interpretation and this, okay. And then next, as some years go, and I start being asked more and more, please sing, please sing. So eventually I do a singing record just as a special project. And the project did great. Mm. And everybody loved. And then I still went back to more instrumental. And then back in 2003, 5 years ago or 4 years ago, I did a recording called Dreamer. That's when I went to Sony BMG, and mm-hmm. they said, please do a recording that is all vocal. We're going to tie your hands on the piano bench. We want to hear you sing. I said, well, I will do this one only. I said, but I'll do this one special project. And I did it. And the record did so well. And there was I, traveling all over the world, singing in every concert, singing and playing. incorporating this new instrument, this new way of communicating with the audience into my shows and the work I do. And since then, there has been no return. I mean, the singing became such a strong part of what I do. And I discovered even a deeper way of communicating with the audience. Mm-hmm. You know, the word has such power, you know, and the human voice. And there's a certain vulnerability to that and a way of communicating that is fantastic. And that incorporated into the piano playing and the together with the piano and everything, and it became really a voice, you know, and something that I do and I've been doing. And now you can see the results because I continue doing it. But originally I didn't think that I was going to do this. You know, it just happened that it went that way, you know.
That's how all the most important stuff does happen, though.
Right? Interesting, no?
We don't have control over that. Now, I don't want to keep you longer than you want to be here, so I'm going to move to a couple of last questions, and then I will ask you to introduce some of the songs that are on your album for me, and then a couple of IDs or sweepers, whatever you want to call them, so that we can introduce your songs or your... Anyway, we'll get to that. So can you tell us what is one of the most memorable things that has ever happened to you in your very long career as a performer?
That's a very hard question.
I know.
Because I can't tell just one thing. I mean, there were so many things that were important
Sounds
to
like
me.
It.
You know, so many breakthroughs. I mean, so many things. I told you when I was 17 years old with being with Jobim Vinicius. When I moved to New York, I was with Steps Ahead. I was 22 years old playing with, you know, Michael Bracker, Peter Erskine, Michael Manieri, Eddie Gomez, great players. And then
players.
I was signed to Blue Note Records and doing all of my work with them. I mean, I work with the Mingus Dynasty. I have done, you know, for example, Bob Brookmeyer, who's a legendary arranger, has arranged 7 of my compositions. That was a Grammy-nominated recording, and arranged for the Danish Radio Jazz Orchestra, which became a CD with 22-piece big band, to hear the music that I wrote, you know, into this way. There's so many things that were so wonderful. You know, more recently, there was something that came full circle. You know, when I was a kid, I used to transcribe Bill Evans, his music.
And you recorded a recent album.
Yes, but it came to my hands, a little cassette that Bill Evans had recorded and gave to Mark Johnson, the bassist, 1 week before he died, saying, "These are the new tunes I'm working on. Hold on to this, you know, I don't know, do what you want," he said to Mark. And he died a week later. This came to my hands, you know, and I was like 10 years old when I transcribed him. It's like 30-something years later, I was with the very last things that he wrote, transcribing his piano, feeling something I thought I would never feel again, that emotion, that closeness, you know. And then I recorded Here's Something For You, which was the last song he ever wrote. So there's so many things that have happened.
Wow.
That would be not fair for me to just say one thing, you know. Has been a life in music and a relationship, you know, with music, that it's all of it is so valuable to me.
Does it feel preordained to you, the way things happen? It seems the way you're describing it is just a remarkable journey.
Yes. You know, sometimes I look back and it looks like this whole puzzle, that there were pieces all apart, and I look and I see, oh, I see why that happened, how that went, and it was put together. You know, it's really incredible. Yeah.
I think that's true for almost all of our lives. If we look
isn't
back,
it,
we see how
it
gets put back together that
yes.
way.
Yes.
Don't know
and then we understand, you know, how things happened the way they happened. But just to see it unfold.
It's not always fun when it's unfolding.
No, that's true. That's part of it, too.
Absolutely.
Sure.
So in your very long career, even though you're certainly not very old, but your career has been very long, what have you learned what is your value system? I can tell that your musicianship, and you're obviously very hardworking, and it seems like you have a very strong sense of truth.
Yes.
To the music and the lyric.
Yes, I do. I mean, I think the artistic expression or doing everything that I do, I am fully into it. And I would not do something that I don't feel. And the importance of my relationship with the music comes before I present the work to anyone, to the public. But then my relationship with the public is, or in the fans, is extremely important too. So all of that together, you know, my artistry and whatever I feel with music, combined with the idea that I want to bring to the listener something that they can stay with, that they can hang with, that they can bring an emotion, whatever that is, something, whatever it can bring to them, that is something good and positive, and that is kind of the guideline, you know, for what I do.
That was a beautiful rap. I'm not going to touch that with a 10-foot pole.
Was it?
That was gorgeous. That was just like, but it, so now let's move on. Which I had to call a Brazilian friend because I wouldn't have known.
Yeah, yeah.
But tell me about Chega de Saudade.
Chega de Saudade was one of the first songs back in 1958 that launched the Bossa Nova. And the lyrics are beautiful. The song has been recorded so many times, but this is a time that I am recording, singing the song, and there's a little solo in the middle of the song that is actually a transcription of Tuan Jo being played, the little solo on his recording. So it's a special moment.
That's fabulous. Okay, and Desafinado?
Desafinado is a song that was also part of the launching of the Bossa Nova back in 1958, and it was quite advanced for that time. People were feeling that, wow, what are those harmonies? It's a little bit strange, you know, the way it was done. And but the tune took off beautifully and is a tune very rich, and it's a great vehicle for jazz players, for musicians, and the lyric is fantastic. And it's a tune that I really love. I actually have been closing my concerts for many years with an instrumental version of Desafinado, but this time is a vocal version.
Can you translate Desafinado for us a little bit?
A little bit. It says, Desafinado means off-key, out of tune.
Okay.
So is this person saying to the other, if you're saying that I'm out of tune, you know, you're provoking, you're hurting me to say that. Because not only the people that are singing tune, you know, have feelings, you know, I inside of the chest of somebody who is not musical like you, or he's telling the other person, you know, also has a heart that beats and, you know, basically talks about that, about being out of tune, somebody who sings out of tune, but still has something of heart beating for the music, mm-hmm. you know.
And can you translate Chega de Saudade for me?
Yeah, Chega de Saudade is a beautiful song because it talks about sadness going away and go far away and tell her, you know, tell this person that without her, I just can't be. And tell her to regress, to come back. Mm-hmm. And when she comes back, it's going to be this, then he talks about, it's going to be this great day full of little hugs and little kisses. And I'm going to kiss you more than the amount of little fishes that are under the sea. and I want to end with this business of you living away from me. So it's like no more, because saudade means nostalgia, means missing someone. And chega means enough of it. So enough of feeling that. Come back. And then it tells about how it's going to be.
And minha saudade?
Minha saudade is minha.
Minha, okay.
Minha saudade. Minha saudade basically means my nostalgia or me missing you. You know, those have love lyrics, romantic lyrics, all of the songs.
Well, unless you speak Portuguese, sometimes you miss
Oh, sure.
The nuance that lyric is bringing, right?
Of course.
You can enjoy the tempo, which the bossa nova brings, but if you don't know the nuance of the lyric, and they're never sung in English, are they? I hope not, actually.
No, they're not. Those do not have English lyrics. Ipanema, the girl from Ipanema has. That's why I did English and Portuguese, but the others, no, they don't.